I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You can still see the window of the villa where Leonardo da Vinci is said to have painted his portrait of Lisa Gherardini, or Mona Lisa. When Martin Kemp made one of his writing trips to Tuscany, he actually stayed at the villa, and Marco the gardener showed him that window. Kemp, however, remains suspicious about the accuracy of the observation. He thinks the landscape in the painting is, in fact, more likely an invention of the Renaissance painter. The search for what was real and the attempt to unravel what was going on in Leonardo's magnificent mind are at the very center of Martin's new book, Leonardo. And it's not just the paintings, nor is it the more far-fetched and recent imaginings of a Da Vinci Code that help us inside the workings of that mind. Martin Kemp says the keys are in fact the notebooks, thousands of pages of dense doodling and writing and sketching that reveal the true genius of Leonardo da Vinci. That it's these pages where we'll discover what it is about the man's mind that link the painting of Mona Lisa with the sketches of flying machines. We invite you to join our conversation this hour. What is it that fascinates you about Leonardo? Is it his work as a philosopher? His work as an architect, an engineer, a painter, or a writer? And why is it that we keep going back to re-examine or to reinvent the man? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Martin Kemp is going to be joining us very shortly from a studio at Oxford where he works as a professor of art history. Before we turn to Martin, though, just an observation on this week's news. In fact, this story from Wednesday from Rome, and it says that researchers have discovered the hidden laboratory used by Leonardo da Vinci for studies of flight and other pioneering scientific work in previously sealed rooms at a monastery next to the Basilica of the Santissima Annunziata in the heart of Florence. These workshop rooms, apparently, located between an Institute for Military Geography and the Basilica, contain frescoes painted by Leonardo that have, and this is in quotes, impressive resemblances to other examples of his experimental work. The frescoes include a triptych of birds circling above a subsequently erased representation of the Virgin Mary that, again in quotes, constitutes a clear citation of the studies by the maestro on the flight of birds. The three researchers, Alessandro Del Meglio, Roberto, and Maria Caccio, said yesterday. In fact, there is an angel at the side of the fresco scene bearing a striking resemblance to the angel in a painting of the Annunciation attributed to Leonardo in the Uffizi Gallery. At least that's what they're saying. What's interesting about the discovery that they've come across in Rome is that it actually brings us to the very center of the conversation that we'll be having with Martin Kemp, and that is that we are forever looking for opportunities to reinvent Leonardo da Vinci. We all know about the stunning success of Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, which has been now almost a year and a half on the New York Times bestseller list. There is this discovery of the hidden laboratory, which is making news in Rome. And in fact, there is an opening in Rome, which also came this week, of another major exhibit of 70 tables from Leonardo's Codex Atlanticus, incorporating his visions of flying and other machines at Rome's Academy. This will be the only chance, says the exhibition's curator, for many people to see the Codex. And I am told that Martin Kemp has taken his seat at the studio in Oxford. Martin, it's good to have you with us on the program.
Thank you very much. By the skin of my teeth.
I a couple of minutes ago posed a question that you pose in the book Leonardo, and I wanted to begin with that because for me it's a kind of key. It's an open door on the way that you're looking at this man's mind. And the question is, what in fact do the Mona Lisa and Leonardo's design for the flying machine have in common?
In one sentence, they're both the remaking of nature. Now, that one sentence obviously has an enormous amount behind that. But fundamentally, what Leonardo was trying to do was to understand nature so well, how it worked, not just how it looked, but how it actually worked, its inner laws, its workings, its causes, that he could then, in paintings or in engineering, remake nature in a new form. So the Mona Lisa is, in a sense, a remaking of that woman. It in a way, isn't a portrait in that photographic sense. And I think we'd be rather surprised if she looked like that. The flying machine is equally not making a bird, literally, but is making a bird-like or bat-like thing, according to a deep understanding of how nature works.
And you also draw our attention away from the character of Lisa herself to the landscape that exists behind her as, well, perhaps not equally important, but a very important part of understanding what it was that he was trying to do in remaking nature.
Exactly. I think what is happening here is that something that begins as a portrait, and it's a perfectly standard thing, Francesco del Giocondo commissions a portrait of his wife, or maybe Mona Lisa's family, the Gherardini, who were certainly linked into Leonardo's father. And it began as a portrait, a standard kind of thing. And in the course of working on it a long time, it turned into a meditation about not just the sitter, but about the woman's body, the human body in general, in relation to the body of the earth. And the body of the earth is a term that Leonardo himself uses.
I wonder, though, was he saying that everything comes from nature or everything imitates nature, or nature is the guide? Exactly, because the connections, this sort of geometrical connections that you're following in these notebooks seem to be more than just a sort of casual observation on his part.
Yeah, Leonardo was never a casual observer. I think he couldn't look at anything. He was like sort of a supercharged kid in a way. He never looked at anything and said, "That's a leaf." He would say, "Why is it darker on top and lighter underneath? Why does it have veining in the leaf that looks like the veins on the back of my hand? Or why does the branching in the veins in the leaf look like the tree itself? And why do they look like river deltas?" So he's always inquiring and saying, why does it look like it does, and why does it look like other things?
Martin, you write that he claimed to be a man without learning. So where did this mind come from?
To some extent, that's a rhetorical claim. You find it quite a lot in Shakespeare's Polonius, who's a kind of learned man in Hamlet, sort of says, I'm a man without learning. So to some extent, it's a kind of rhetorical claim to say, well, I don't really know much, but I've got a lot of common sense and I've looked at things hard. But by the standards of the university-educated people, he struggled with Latin. He didn't have this vast grounding. But I think, like a lot of amazing people who've got very quick minds, they could get a hint. He could read in Dante what the philosophical, scientific ideas were behind Dante, and he could seize on that quicker than somebody who had read a whole book of Aristotle.
One of my colleagues who was turning the pages on the book and noting that he had his fingers in so many pies said, you know, if this man were to live today, we'd say he has ADD, that he begins so many things and doesn't finish them, that he has all these different areas of interest and not even the time in the waking day to complete the projects that he had sort of imagined.
Yeah, I define it as attention deficit superfluity rather than disorder. And he did manage, in a sense, to hold all these interests together. What happened was, obviously, that to finish, in our terms, any single thing became very difficult, even to finish a painting, because the demands he made on the painting, the anatomy, the landscape, the optics, every element, how the drapery fell, how the atmosphere worked to blur things in the distance, all, you know, he's simply making demands on painting which not even film as a moving medium could meet. But at the same time, there is this wonderful unity, and I think, you know, we can appreciate that, even though there is the frustration that it was difficult for him to settle on a ring-fenced area and really push that to a conclusion.
I should let our listeners know that we have borrowed a couple of the plates from the book for our website. We're at theconnection.org, and you can see some of the notebooks that Martin has been studying and get an idea of the way that the sort of dense and compact and busy mind that Leonardo had. One of the images that caught my attention Martin, and you focus on it as well, is his fascination with water. You call that part the vortex. Where did that come from for him?
I think water was a wonderful element for him because it moved, and to a degree you could see it moving. And with air, this wasn't the wasn't so much the case. Fire was very evanescent, you know, it would spring up and go before you could capture it. And earth, other than in floods and so on, didn't move very much, or in earthquakes. So it was the ideal medium. And he wanted to understand the dynamic forces in nature. And as he looked at them and thought about how does a bird fly and the kind of turbulence of the air, which he had a sense of, though you can't literally see it, what happens when a boat goes through water? What happens in a flood? What happens in a great storm? And he's looking for the ubiquitous signs of motion. And inside the heart, he would see in microcosm, literally in a lesser world, a kind of deluge of activity, a storm going on inside the heart. So this motion, this turbulent motion of elements, he was obsessed with and saw as an absolute key to movement, life and force. And of course, water is heavy. You can put grains inside it. You can stain it in various ways so you can see what is happening.
Martin Kemp is my guest. His new book is called Leonardo, and it takes us inside the mind of the man. That's where we'll be for the balance of the hour. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What is it that attracts you 500 years later to the mind of Leonardo da Vinci? Because we keep coming back to it. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Martin Kemp is our guest this hour. He's a professor of art history at Oxford and author of a brand new book called Leonardo, which talks about the way that that marvelous mind worked. And Martin, just before we went to the break, we were talking about water. There's one more part of that that I wanted to ask you about, and it was that I was reading the book at the same time as the scientific world, our modern-day scientific world, was trying to make sense of the tsunami. And I was watching a science channel where particularly brilliant man had created this computer model where he was saying, you know, if there was an earthquake in the Pacific Ocean close to California on the shore of Canada, this is how it would come ashore. And he'd actually, you know, had the ricochets of the waves going off this island and onto this shore. And the commentator was saying that, you know, this sort of thing was fairly new. And I thought to myself, my God, Leonardo da Vinci was doing the same thing with a piece of charcoal in his notebooks.
Absolutely. In a way, he is trying to understand how nature works, and then he can model it. And it is exactly like computer modeling, in as much as you put in the basic parameters, you've understood of the phenomena, and then you run with it. So these water drawings are not so much miraculous photographs of water in action as synthetic models of everything he knows about water. And one very nice example is towards the end of his life, he made a study of a heart valve, a pulmonary valve in the heart, which has got three cusps. And he looked at the structure of the valve and the neck of the aorta, the neck of the main blood vessel, which constricts pretty rapidly. And he worked out how he thought the vortices would go, how the blood would curl, how it would close the valve automatically through its turbulence. And with a very brilliant scientist, a professor at Caltech, we've modeled how that valve would work and how a modern valve works using modern imaging techniques, and Leonardo got it spot on.
Wow.
So in a sense, he is doing computer modeling or that kind of synthetic modeling long before, of course, we had the tools we have now.
Now, he didn't have that kind of algorithmic mind that allowed him to do this all with figures in his head. But he did have the ability to do what? Because he must have been able to do something with his imagination, which I can't even conceive of.
He was, along with Kepler, the astronomer, and a few others one could name, one of the most brilliant three-dimensional modelers. He could work through three-dimensional phenomena in his head and, as it were, let the machine run, in some cases literally a machine, or in some cases the mental model he's building. He wasn't any good at arithmetic. If you gave him a column of 10 figures, he would get it wrong. But he had this amazing ability to do three-dimensional dynamic geometric sculpture. That sounds like rather a kind of collection of words, but you know, he basically could sculpt all this stuff spatially in his head as it moved. And he had no algebra either.
You make the observation, Martin, that you could actually look at one of his portraits and see in the twist of the curl of a woman's hair the same kind of turn that he was using in his notebooks to outline the current of water. Now, was that just chance, a little bit of the engineer in him spilling over to the artist in him, or was there more going on there than that?
No, he saw the analogy of forms and of movements, above all movements, as the key to how we could understand how nature works. And there's a wonderful page in Windsor where there's an old man on one side sitting, and on the other side there's a very brilliant study of water passing past a bar or an obstacle inside it. And underneath he says, look at the movement of hair which resembles that of water. And he analyzes what they've got in common. So it is absolutely a fundamental method for Leonardo. Analogy is how he hopes to unpick how the world works.
We're going to go for our first call to Williamsville, New York. Alan's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I have a question for the professor. In view of your comments about his use of space and visual imagination, if you look at the painting that you were just talking about, the Mona Lisa, I think in the background there's a considerable discrepancy that's been commented on by a number of people. For example, the...
How could the water over her right shoulder match up with the water that sort of up at the level of her left ear, right?
I'm curious to know what you make of that. What do you think he was trying to say? What do you think he was trying to do with that? Why is there this discrepancy of horizons?
Thank you, Alan. It's a good question. I could preface my answer by saying there have been all sorts of interpretations about it, ranging from kind of high Freudian to kind of low daft. But I think what is going on here is actually in his notebooks. He sees the body of the Earth as something dynamic. And there's a wonderful description where, having worked on an Arno canal, on a canal in the river Arno near Florence, he observed that at one time in Tuscany there were two great lakes, a high lake and a low lake, and at some point in the distant past the river barriers have broken, the rock dams, as it were, have broken, and one lake has drained into another. That lake subsequently has broken and turned into the river. So I think what we're seeing there, in a sense, is the working through of an ancient dynamic process by which a high lake breaks into a low lake, and the low lake then breaks into the river. So the Earth is a living body, changing and moving, which, of course, in Renaissance terms is extraordinary, where the Earth is meant to be created by God as it is and doesn't change.
Let's hear from David, who's joining us on the line from Boston. Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Just a question for the professor. I was just wondering how someone who was like Leonardo would manifest themselves in today's society. I mean, where he was, there were all these things for him to explore and discover, but a lot of those things, like in nature, like the veins on the leaves, are sort of already understood to a great extent by people. So how would Leonardo, living today, how do you think he'd manifest himself?
I mean, would he be a painter? Would he be a pilot? Would he be a computer modeler, that sort of thing?
Well, but also, would he do so many things, or would he really just latch on to something? And if he did so many things, how would he get that deep into them when so many other people have gone so deep into these areas?
Martin?
I think the first thing to say is, with a mind like that, he would be akin to some people we meet who do have this extraordinary protean range of interests. But I think professionally, he would have been in media that move. If you look at his drawings, you can get a sense of frustration that the drawings won't move. As far as drawings can move, he makes them move. But
They almost, Martin, at one point, excuse me for interrupting, but that, you know, those little stick men that you could do on the corner of your school book and flip the pages when class got boring. Those things look like they're in the notebooks. Am I reading too much into it?
There's a particular page where there's a man hammering, and he's got him in, I think, in five different positions sequentially through the sequence. And Leonardo emphasizes that any drawing is a freezing, as it were, of a continuous movement. And all his drawings of phenomena try to capture this idea that it isn't a static thing, it's not a frozen thing, that everything is always in flux and moving. So I think if I had to put my money on him having a professional engagement in any area, he would be filmmaker, computer animation, in a dynamic area. I think he wouldn't have painted because he would have loved the paintings to have moved.
And there's something about his fascination with light which bears that out as well. You talk about him seeing intensity of light, using the word percussion to describe intensity of light. And I had to think about that a little bit before I understood what he's saying and what you're helping me with.
Yeah, percussion, percussione, lovely word. It is the word he uses. And he thinks about how light hits a surface. And to understand the grades of light, say, on a human head, he will say if the blow comes straight down and hits perpendicularly, that's, say, straight on the surface, it makes a big blow. It's as if you had an axe cutting down into wood. You know, if you go straight down, it's a powerful blow. And the more glancing it gets, the shallower the angle, the less percussione there is, the less percussion, the less impact. So he's coming up with a law which says that if light falls directly on something, it's very bright. It looks very luminous. If it falls at an angle, if the shallower the angle, the less bright it is. This is very similar to what computer modeling does when they use ray tracing. You know, when in computer graphics you have a notional light source and then you ping a whole series of light rays onto the object. And the law that's used is actually an 18th century law formulated by a German mathematician called Lambert, with maths that Leonardo didn't have. But his basic insight was that there was a mathematical process at work in the way in which light hit a form and the force it makes, as it were. It's like a bouncing ball or an axe or a blow. It's a wonderful mechanical notion of the magic of light.
My guest is Martin Kemp. We're talking about his new book, Leonardo, and the work of the man as a philosopher and an architect and an engineer and a painter and a writer, and why it is we remain so fascinated with the man. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I want to just ask one more question, if I might, Martin, about this man's connection or affection for light. It's the description of lumen, I think it's pronounced lumen cinerum, ashen light.
Yeah. What? He saw light as an amazing force in nature. Ultimately, he knew that the sun's light gave warmth and that generated the light in the universe. And he was fascinated by, I suppose, what we would call the sensuous qualities of light, how it goes through atmospheres, how it rebounds. And what you're referring to, the lumen generarum, is a beautiful observation. If you look at the moon when it's a crescent moon, on the dark side, you see this little glimmer of light, just an ashen light. Lumen generarum means ashen or ashy light. And nobody had described that before. Galileo was later to describe it a century later. And Leonardo says, how can we understand that? And he works out how that light gets from the sun, rebounds off the Earth sees, and goes back to the moon. And he does a study to show how that happens. And on the Earth, it's rather like, for instance, if we're wearing a white shirt or a white blouse, and the light is coming from above, the bottom of our chin picks up that ashen light, as it were, this slight glow from the reflected light. So it's both intellectual and wonderfully sensual in a way.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us this hour. We're going next to Cranston, Rhode Island. Andrew's on the line. Andrew, thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Thank you. I read the Da Vinci Code, and I found it a really interesting read. I know it only scratches the surface of Leonardo's inner workings, but, you know, you have to start somewhere. And I'm a numbers guy, and there was one thing that really stood out for me was when they talked about a number called, I'd never heard of it, the phi or phi, I'm not really sure it's pronounced, which was the divine proportion, 1.68 or something like that, where everything that's created or a lot of things that are created in this proportion. And I wanted to see if the professor can comment on this number. I was sort of in disbelief, didn't really believe it until I looked at my hand and its validity and Da Vinci's involvement with it.
Yep. Leonardo certainly knew the golden section, the golden mean, which is this particular proportion, which has particular ratio. But for him, it was just one of many. He was also interested in other proportions, musical and geometrical. The obsession with the golden section really is a late 19th century, 20th century thing. So what essentially Dan Brown has done in a work of very inventive fiction is to take back later notions of the power and ubiquity of the golden section and transfer it to Leonardo, which a historian would hesitate to do, but of course a writer of fiction has an enviable license in doing that kind of thing.
Does Brown go beyond or into areas where Leonardo might not have been? I mean, how much here is invented? Have you taken a look at that?
Oh, I've looked at the Da Vinci Code, and it's a very effective work of fiction, and that's what it is. And I would say to your listeners that don't expect that to be a work of literal historical research presented by a historian as research any more than we would read, say, Shakespeare's Macbeth to find out the true history of a Scottish king. It's a work of fiction which builds lots of brilliant fantasies around the kind of bare bones of what we know about Leonardo.
But the other reason that it works, Martin, is because we do have this amazing fascination with this one man, and we go back to him. We go back to him sort of every century, or so it seems, with some new construction or some new idea of who he was and what he meant and how he thought. And I don't know. I know that you've spent a lot of time studying the man. Have you figured out why he has that that draw?
I think, and it's a question which I've never quite got the right answer to, but let me have another go at it. I think we have, as curious human beings, when we look at things and think about things, a set of wonders and questions. And this crosses science and arts. The scientist looks at something and gets interested because it's wonderful and then does a lot of hard grinding work to explain it. The artist looks at something and says, how can I extract something from that to use in my art? And he was able to do it across this full range of things, of the arts and sciences. So I think more than any other figure, he knows the itches which we all need to scratch as curious people when we look at nature and when we think about things. And he ultimately didn't come up with the solutions to all these things, almost needless to say. But I think we can share that sense of both wonder and the need to answer the questions.
All right, and it's those questions we're focusing on this hour in The Connection with Martin Kemp, who's the author of a new book called Leonardo. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're here to welcome your questions as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Leonardo da Vinci loved to draw, but he also loved to write. And from his notebooks, a short little passage about water reads as follows. The water, finding itself in the proud sea, its own element, was overcome with a desire to rise above the air, and encouraged by the fiery element, raised itself as a subtle vapor, appearing almost as rarefied as the air, and moving higher it reached more rarefied and chilly air, where it was abandoned by the fire, and the minute particles became constrained, were united and made heavy, whence fell its pride, and it was thrown into flight, and fell from the sky. Then it was swallowed up by the dry earth, where it was imprisoned for a long time, doing penance for its sin. My guest is Martin Kemp. This is a passage from his new book, Leonardo. And Martin, I wanted to ask you whether or not he was playing there, or he really believed that there was this kind of life force even in the particles of water.
Yeah, that's a lovely passage, isn't it? And there are similar ones. We tend to think of Leonardo as this sort of remorseless searcher of physical truths. But the Book of Nature was also full of meaning. And as a true inheritor of a medieval as well as a pioneer of a modern worldview, he is interested, as it were, in the lessons, in what nature means, what content it has. He thought about animals in terms of the moral lessons they are often thought to raise in the Middle Ages and the medieval period. So this is, to us, it's a clever literary conceit, and it undoubtedly is a clever literary conceit. But I think we should take it seriously that he would see nature as a book in which you read everything you needed to know, from moral philosophy to proof of the existence of a divine creator to lessons about how to make machines.
We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina for our next call. Phil's on the line. Hi, Phil. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. I love the show.
Great. Go ahead.
Well, I had a question about, I knew a lot of high Renaissance thinkers were influenced by the politics of Italy, like men like Michelangelo in particular, and I was aware that some of Leonardo's inventions were war machines. And I was curious if these or other ideas were influenced by the volatile politics of Renaissance Italy.
Do you mean commissioned by the politicians, Phil?
Yes, indeed.
Martin.
Yeah. Hello. Nice to hear from someone from Durham. I was a visiting professor at UNC Chapel Hill at one point. So Durham I know well.
A little nostalgia going on here.
Leonardo was very ambivalent towards war. He called war beastly madness, and he wrote short literary snippets about the destructive power of weaponry. And he undoubtedly was a humane man who appreciated what war could do. Yet he was fascinated by the power of war machines. I mean, of all the machines anyone could invent in the time, these were the ones which had the most awesome power. And of course, if you wish to make a living as someone who didn't make many paintings, then a prince would be interested in his prowess in this direction. And a painter was moderately well paid and decently looked after in court. But if you could promise to win battles, then you were a big deal for your patron. So there's all sorts of complicated agendas in there of dislike of war, of fascination with the war machine, and just the practical business of how you earn your crust of bread.
Describe the crossbow that he has in his notebooks, if you would, Martin.
Yes, he devised a gigantic crossbow. We can tell its scales. He writes about it, but also a little man standing beside it. It is sort of 40, 50 feet wide. An enormous machine with great screws to pull back the string of the bow. And the bow itself is made of a series of slipping laminations. So you couldn't just, you know, put a tree trunk up there and pull it, as it would break. And for a television program, we did try to reconstruct that. And initially, the engineers said, oh, I think we can do this better. We know how that will work. And the bow split. It was this very thick bow. Is a dreadfully difficult thing, but once they got the idea that he had these laminations which slid over each other, held together with iron ties, then they got something which potentially would work very brilliantly. So it's both a great fantasy, but also full of really hard-nosed practical solutions.
It looks like something from the battlefield of the Lord of the Rings, which you see it in his book.
Yeah, absolutely. That's maybe what he would be doing, Deku. Maybe he'd be a film graphics designer working in a Hollywood studio
on
fantastic
effects.
Machines.
Yeah. Hyde Park, Massachusetts, for our next call. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
How are you?
I'm well. Thanks. Thanks for joining us. What are you thinking?
Thanks so much for the show. At the risk of sounding somewhat arrogant to the professor, I want to defend Leonardo as a painter. And I think if he was alive today, I think he would be painting. Because when there's nothing in my experience of any film that I've ever seen that compares with being in the presence of one of those luridly painted illusions that Leonardo has given us. And I think that they're so compelling because they don't move. They sort of arrest time in a way, and they arrest the viewer. So I think that painting, especially as it's going on right now, is so wide open and such an exciting place that I think Leonardo would probably be innovating as a painter. And I don't think that he would be, working for Pixar or something like that. I just want your thoughts on that, and I'll take my answer.
You didn't like the talking clownfish, Steve? Is that what...
Well, it really didn't do it for me. The enunciation up against the talking clownfish, I just I'll take the enunciation. I'll take my answer.
What do you think, Martin? Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Maybe not Pixar, but if you look at some of the great visual filmmakers who are working with great cameramen. But no, I think what is actually being said is rather persuasive. We're speculating about what Leonardo would do, but I think that's a terrific defense of painting and the possibility he would still be engaging with it. And I think that sounds pretty good to me.
All right, Steve, thanks for that. To Barrington, Rhode Island, Gareth's on the line. Hi, Gareth, what are you thinking?
Good morning. I'd just like to say that one of the problems with talking about Leonardo is that we mythologize him. We only talk about the things he gets right. He got things wrong as well, which makes him a real person.
Do you want to give us an example of something that sticks in your mind, Gareth?
Yes. In the notebooks, and Mr. Kemp knows much more about this than I do, but he talks about proportional systems for the human figure. He talks about from the point of the nose to the point of the chin, etc. Well, there are no intrinsic points on a curved surface, so the whole system of proportion, I think, is somewhat arbitrary and baseless, and yet it's become so influential and assumed to be the way we measure the figure. I wondered what Mr. Kemp might say about that and whether he has any other criticisms of Leonardo's work.
Go ahead, Martin.
Shall I go ahead, Dick?
Yeah, please.
You can go through Leonardo, if you wish, sort of ticking and crossing, like marking a school book, saying, well, he got that right, he got that wrong. And this is undoubtedly significant, and you can do that. And, if we're talking about one of the things we have been thinking about is water, the whole framework he used to explain the movement of water, the dynamic law, was that of an ancient Greek law formulated by Aristotle. And he didn't know about Newtonian dynamics, obviously, which were a century later. So in that sense, you can go through and say, yes, he got that wrong, he got that more or less right, he got that completely right. And it's an interesting exercise. But I'm actually more interested in saying, why did he have the total set of beliefs he had? And how can we appreciate the beauty and sheer intelligence and ambition of the quest? And whether he got things right or wrong is clearly important, but for me as a student of Leonardo, understanding the fundamental human quest behind that, and you talk about him being a human being, yes, and that is the fascination for me, not so much just sort of scoring off the yeses and nos. Yes, he got plenty wrong, and ultimately the whole framework of physics he was working with was one which we now know is faulty.
Gareth, did you want to add anything?
Well, I mean, Mr. Kemp's position, I understand. I just simply think that it would be useful not just to be negative about it. Of course, I admire Leonardo's work. Who couldn't? But it would be very useful to put his ideas into perspective, I think, more than they are being done. We tend to take this, as I say, mythologizing view of him, as if he was a sort of exceptional genius, which he was. But The things that he got wrong, I think, are useful. The things he got right.
I wonder if I can step in here and ask Martin to help us with another aspect of the scholarship here. And Gareth, I'm not stepping away from this, but we only have a small number of the pages of his notebooks, if I understand correctly. Is that right, Martin?
My estimate would be, and you can do it by various techniques, would be that probably only one in five of his pages survive. So there's an enormous amount missing. I think it wouldn't alter the overall picture of what Gareth has been talking about. And I agree entirely. We shouldn't mythologize him. We shouldn't make him the inventor of everything that we now have, bicycles, refrigerators, the whole shooting match. That does him no favors. Seeing him as a man ahead of his time is a formula I don't like. He is the most wonderful man working with the vision of his time. He is not anticipating the modern age in that sense. I don't like that formula. And what I've been trying to do with Leonardo, particularly in the first chapter, is to look and say, who is this man? What do we know about him? How did he make his career? Can we give a real sense? And from that base, to go in to see, can we get a sense of how his mind worked as a whole, without over-mythologizing it and without trying to diminish it? And I think the more you look at the total nature of the quest and the vision, it looks more and more remarkable to me, but not the same as the myth.
Back at the beginning of the program, I was noting the news story that's come from Rome this week about the discovery of a supposed discovery of a hidden laboratory used by Leonardo da Vinci. What have you made any calls on that? Have you looked into that as perhaps a source for more about the man, Martin?
I haven't seen the visuals of that yet. I haven't seen what the frescoes, the decorations appear like. Nobody, I think, is claiming them to be Leonardo's. But we know that when Leonardo came back from Florence in 1500, the Duke of Milan's reign had collapsed. The French had invaded, and Leonardo came back to Florence with a mathematician friend, whose books he'd already illustrated. And they were put up in this monastery of Santissima Annunciata, the monastery of the Most Holy Annunciation, and they were there for a short period. And I think the monks were hoping that Leonardo would finish the altarpiece, which one or two artists had been involved with but was never completed. In fact, Leonardo worked on a completely different project, along with probably lots of bits of science. He worked on a cartoon, a full-scale drawing of the Virgin Child and St. Anne. So he was certainly there. And I'm looking forward immensely to seeing what has been discovered.
1-800-423-8255, next to Newton, Massachusetts. And Jim's on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I'd like to go back to the question of patronage. And if I have my history right, Leonardo's last patronage was in a town called Amboise, France, where he got to by riding a donkey with his manuscripts in a saddlebag. And I wonder what comments you have on that. And did he accomplish anything notable during that period of his life?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. His last employment, his last patron, was Francis I, the King of France, and he was put up in some style. He had a manor house, a rather grand house called Clos Lucet near Amboise. So he didn't end up like the kind of penniless artist living in a garret. And he was there for at least 3 years. He seems to have had a stroke at some point and wasn't in the best of health. But Francis I, the French king, and we have the testimony of Benvenuto Cellini, an Italian sculptor who worked at the court, delighted in Leonardo's company. He saw him as a great wise man. And I think at the end of his life in France, he wasn't so much expected to do concrete work, so that would have been nice, but he was regarded as an ornament of the court, somebody who was immensely wise. And Francis was reported as saying that he didn't think anyone had ever been born who knew as much about everything as Leonardo.
We call those public intellectuals today, don't we? Ornaments of the court.
I think the difference is that they're really popular in the Renaissance and they're regarded with suspicion today.
Were there people back then who had commissioned things like the altarpiece or paintings or sculptures that were never completed, who regarded Leonardo da Vinci as a bit of a deadbeat, somebody who couldn't finish what he was starting. I mean, how did he get past that?
If you look at the documentation of his relationship with patrons, there's always a note of impatience. You know, the Duke of Milan writes to his secretary saying, you know, get Leonardo to finish that and then get him onto the other wall, as it were. So that note of impatience is always there. But I think we shouldn't concentrate too much on unfinished paintings, that in a court context, we know he did all sorts of things. He designed wonderful stage sets. He designed costumes for pageants. He put on extraordinary tricks like turning water into wine. And there's lots of things he did to earn his keep. He also did lots of bits and pieces of engineering. He made jacks, he made locks, lots of not very exciting stuff, in which the record has survived in a rather meager way. So I think he was continually busy, and he did deliver things for patrons, but he didn't deliver many finished paintings.
And as a scholar who studied him as carefully as you have, I'm wondering if what's finished and what's not isn't in fact more useful in terms of figuring out how his brain works rather than frustrating. Darn, I wish he'd finished that painting. I'd know more about the man.
Certainly now we have this interest in how somebody thinks, how, say, Newton, the great scientist, thinks. At one time, Newton's papers were curiosities. Now they, for us, we're interested in mental processes, become of immense interest. I think we're better placed not just to say, well, there are 20 paintings, why didn't he do more, why are some of them unfinished, but to understand the nature of the creative intellectual processes that are there in the notebooks. And I think that is a continuing source of fascination, the unfinished project, which we can all, in a sense, help finish ourselves.
Martin, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking about Leonardo with us today.
Jake, my pleasure. Everybody on Public Radio does a terrific job, so keep it up.
All right, then. Martin Kemp, author of Leonardo and an art history professor at the University of Oxford. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Schuchert. Particular thanks to Sarah Baker for help with today's program. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.